You're listening to Retronauts, a part of the Greenlit Podcast Network, a collective of creator-owned and fully independent podcasts focused on pop culture and video gaming. To learn more and to catch up on all the other network shows, check out greenlitpodcasts.com. This week in Retronauts, Saru gets you, I choose you. Hi everyone, welcome to Retronauts. I am Jeremy Parrish, and this is another remote pandemic special, another Patreon special, a topic request by one of our patrons, one with a live stream, who is here on the line with me to talk about a series that I don't know that I can necessarily find people in my normal group, the normal Retronauts group that we round up to actually hold court on these games. So it's good you're here. So please introduce yourself and tell us, what is this mysterious topic that has already been given away by the title of the episode?
Well, hello, I'm Joseph Wozniak, and we're going to be talking about the Ape Escape series, which I think a lot of people, the people that play it, have a pretty fond place for it in their heart. But, you know, it's never really talked about, not extensively. So it's kind of like this, I don't want to call it a lost gem, but maybe a little bit of a forgotten one.
Yeah, it's kind of weird. It seemed like it was a really big thing for Sony in the PS1 era. And then I feel like the sequels didn't really gain that much traction. And after the third game, which was 15 years ago, believe it or not, they just kind of said, we'll do some spinoffs, PlayStation All-Stars, I don't know. It just kind of fizzled out. It's been nearly a decade since the last Ape Escape game that I'm aware of. And that was a spinoff. That was, you know, like a party game, which is not really where the series started. It kind of fell into ignominy and basically became a Minions game. Not Minion. What is it? A Rabbids.
Rabbids,
it's all the same thing. Yeah, Rabbids, Minions. What's the difference?
Yeah, no, and we've been kind of endlessly teased since maybe like 2006 about an Ape Escape 4, but nothing's happened. I know that Sony recently created an Ape Escape 4 Twitter handle or something like that, but they did similar things in like 2016, 2012, and nothing came of that either. So fingers crossed, but with how it's been kind of maybe not mishandled, but maybe mishandled is correct, how they've treated the series in the past, you know, hopefully something good will come out of it, but I wouldn't be surprised if it's another weird RPG or party game.
Yeah, I mean, you know, there's always hope. It's always possible that by the time this episode comes out, we're recording it mid-May, the dead-ass center of May. It's possible, but by the time this episode comes out, there will have been an amazing next-generation Ape Escape announced for PlayStation 5 to go along with Shadows of Tsushima or whatever it's called. You know, like really just like, let's blow out the Unreal Engine 5 and show the true power of PlayStation 5 with Ape Escape, but maybe not.
Probably my fingers are crossed that we'll get a super realistic, you know, a super photogenic monkeys that you just chase around everywhere.
FromSoft maybe. Presents
the hardcore Escape review 4. That we really need. Yeah.
Yeah. I don't know about that, but it does seem like maybe the series is just a little lost in history, because the original game, when it came out, was really a technical showcase for the PlayStation 1. And I just don't feel like this is the style of game that you can use as a technical showcase in the year 2020. I think people want something different. And I mean, you look at, so this is recorded a day after Nintendo announced the latest Paper Mario game. Which, yeah. You know, in the way that Nintendo does a lot now, the visual style of that is extremely realistic in a stylized way. They focused, you know, on like very cartoonish characters, but they are made of realistic materials, origami and felt and things like that. So you get this like tactile quality to the visuals. But, you know, people complain about how plain and blank the graphics are. I'm like, no, there's like all this detail going on. There's lots of subtlety. But You know, it's not a realistic craggy mountainside or something, or, you know, 20,000 million polygons in a single girl's face, like the most exquisitely rendered eyelash, more polygons in her eyelash than the original Cloud Strife. You know, I think people just have different metrics, and so time has kind of moved on, and Ape Escape, whatever it becomes in the future, if it becomes anything, I don't know that it can necessarily hold the same place as the original, which was, again, very much to say, like, hey, this is, you know, kind of pushing the boundaries of what the PlayStation, original PlayStation, can do visually, and check it out, new controller. Wow, how about that?
Yeah, I'm reminded of, you know, Nintendo's kind of design philosophy with Mario games, wherein the mechanics of a Mario game are based on the controller, which works really well for them because, you know, every console we get a radically new controller. And so, you know, with Mario Galaxy, you've got the Wiimote and the Nunchuck. With, was there even, I guess there was 3D World on the Wii U. I hope I can't be blamed for forgetting that. Not that that really used the gamepad to any sort of great extent, but like Mario Odyssey on the Switch, you know, you've got really great motion controls and use of the HD rumble, as well as that greater focus on portability, but also like a home experience. Whereas when I look at the PlayStation, ever since the DualShock came out, it's been the same. I know that with the PlayStation 4, they added, you know, the touch bar on it, but there's not many games that are, you know, using it. And I, with how inaccurate it is, I don't think I'd want to use it as a main means of controlling a game. So, you know, who knows what'll happen with the PlayStation 5, but the controller, once again, it's a video game controller, all right. It's pretty similar to the Xbox One controller and the Stadia controller.
But it looks like Bjork.
It looks like Bjork, yeah. But what's also interesting is with Ape Escape, I think they did try to kind of continue that sort of tech demo narrative when the PlayStation Move came out. There was a launch title, Million Monkeys, I think.
It's just called PlayStation Move Ape Escape, I think.
It's like a rail shooter. I think there was a lot of potential to have the gadgets be used with the PlayStation Move controllers, but they didn't really capitalize on that. So who knows what'll happen in the future.
Yeah, it's like there wasn't much that PlayStation Move Ape Escape did that you couldn't have done with like a Wii game 5 years earlier. So
yeah, exactly.
It seems, yeah, kind of like, again, this series just seems sort of lost at sea.
Yeah, and maybe there is potential to kind of be on the cutting edge with it, but when you're following in the footsteps of like Wii Sports and Wii Play, I don't think that's really going to happen.
Yeah. So we kind of did this episode backward. We started with the referendum on the series' future.
Yes.
But we haven't really talked about the series itself. And, you know, as you mentioned, people who've played it generally have very fond feelings for it, and rightly so. Like, it's not my favorite game in the world, but I did enjoy the original, and it has a lot of charm to it. I feel like the gimmickry gets in the way a little bit, but it's very exuberant and has a great personality. And, you know, had enough of a place in history that Konami and Hideo Kojima were like, wow, that is the franchise that we want to hitch our wagon to. This was before Monster Hunter. Before Monster Hunter, the biggest game ever in Japan, basically, Metal Gear was like, Ape Escape. That sounds good. Let's do that one. So, yeah, there have been crossovers.
Yeah, there have been crossovers with, you know, Snake and Metal Gear showing up in Ape Escape, but also Ape Escape showing up in Metal Gear Snake Eater, which is the last sort of crossover I would ever think of having. But I guess it makes sense with the Sony exclusivity.
Well,
but
and also they are both stealth games. I mean, they are very much about sneaking up and using gadgets and using kind of weird controller configurations to perform different maneuvers. So it actually does make sense. And there's even like a funny pun in the Japanese title. It's just called Metal Gear Solid in English, but in Japanese it's Messaru Gear Solid.
Yeah, just like the Japanese title Saru Gecha.
Well, yeah, so metal in Japanese is Metaru, and Saru or monkey is Saru, so Messaru instead of Metaru, you get this kind of layered pun. And I guess, you know, if you really want to stretch it, meh in Japanese is I, so it's like you're looking for the monkeys. So it's very clever, and then it doesn't really come through in English. But to their credit, like, the Metal Gear team really just played it to the hilt. Like, they played it straight. It was like, Colonel, why am I hunting monkeys? And, you know, he just kind of rolled with it. Like, David Hayter put his heart into it, and they just... I guess it wasn't talking to Colonel, was it? Was Missile Gear Solid, was that set in the Snake Eater timeline, or was it set in the modern timeline?
Yes, it's set in the Snake Eater timeline.
So I guess he wasn't talking to the Colonel Campbell. But anyway, the point is, like, they played it straight, and it was great. Like, there is that kind of wacky surrealism to Metal Gear. But that's all kind of a sidebar. The important thing is that Ape Escape itself is based around a pretty solid gameplay concept, and the original was really designed to showcase the PlayStation DualShock controller, dual analog controller, either one. And a little bit of history there, you know, analog controls were kind of a, whoa, what a cool, neat idea back in the mid-90s, and you could buy them for PCs, but the first system to really make it a thing was the N64, which had the, you know, the weird three-prong controller, the middle prong of which had an analog stick on it. And Sony, around that time, introduced a dual analog joystick, which could be used for, like, flight sims and stuff. It supports, like, 100 games, but... it's very kind of inconsistent, and that controller was very, very expensive, and you couldn't really use it for just like standard platformers. But then they turned the original digital-only controller into the dual analog, which had, like, it's a little different than the dual shock because it doesn't have rumble, and the analog sticks are concave rather than convex. So if you play with it and you're used to the dual shock, you're like, whoa, this is weird. What's with the little cups and the analog sticks? But then shortly after that, they were like, oh, yes, we should also put rumble in there. So by the end of 1998, you had the DualShock controller. And the thing is, because it was introduced midway through the PlayStation's life, there weren't that many games that required it. There were games that, you know, could have rumble features or analog features as an option, but all of them supported digital controls as well. So Sony was kind of leading the way here and basically saying, like, hey guys, no, you need to make games exclusively for the analog control scheme and to really take advantage of the opportunities that it offers. And so they created Ape Escape, which does use the DualShock dual analog setup in a way that no game before it really had. You don't use the right stick to control the camera, as would become standard. You use it to basically control kind of your weapons and your actions, which is pretty unusual. It takes a little getting used to, but it is very different, and it really does kind of push the idea of, hey, this is a new interface device, and if you really make use of it exclusively and don't shackle yourself to a digital pad, to a D-pad, you can do new and different things.
Yeah, and I think by having, because it was the first game released that actually did require the DualShock controller, I think there was this great opportunity for Sony to kind of put forth this idea that, like, DualShock can kind of make you feel more like you're in control of your character, because, you know, when you're playing Mario, for example, you use the analog stick to move around, but that's kind of it. But you're right, with Ape Escape, since you're controlling the gadgets as well, there's kind of a bit more of like a one-to-one control style there, which I think really helps with engagement with the game, but also, you know, feeling like you're in control of a character. And it's a shame that a lot of other games haven't really done that, that we've basically relegated the right analog stick to be camera, and that's it.
Yeah, it's kind of like, what if Quap were a game you controlled with two sticks? So you move around with the left stick and you basically aim and fire off your tools and weapons and stuff with the right stick, and that determines how you aim it. And I can't really think of a lot of other games that have done that. I know some have. but for whatever weird reason, like, it's just totally blanking on my mind right now. But I guess you could look back to Karate Champ, you know, a decade before this, or actually a decade and a half before this, in like 1984, and the original arcade game for Karate Champ had two sticks, and the way you press the sticks, like, the, you know, kind of how they were moved in relationship to one another, determined which karate attacks and defenses your on-screen character was using. So it wasn't just like move with the left stick back and forth and then use buttons to attack. It was like move toward, you know, your opponent and press the right stick high and you'll do a high kick, or pull back on both sticks away from the opponent and you'll block, and that sort of thing. So it's kind of building off that idea, but more fluidly and with much greater variety. And in the concept, you know, in the wrapper of a 3D platformer, which was, of course, all the rage in the late 90s. Like, every game wanted to be a 3D platformer. Where did they go?
They're coming back a little bit, you know, with the huge success of Yooka-Laylee.
Was it a huge success?
No, I was being facetious, okay. But...
Yeah, I think the 2D side-scroller did better than the 3D one.
Yeah, which is a shame because a certain period in the 90s is very much defined by the 3D platformer, and you're right, it's completely gone, and even attempts to kind of bring it back, maybe it's that people are older now and maybe a little more cynical and able to realize that maybe these games weren't the best thing ever, but at the same time, things like the Spyro Reignited Trilogy and Crash Insane Trilogy, I think... have helped people realize that these games do still hold up. And so this is a, you know, a means of game design that has a place in the 2020s.
Yeah. And, you know, as of now, there are rumors that Nintendo is bringing back Mario 64 and some of the other Mario 3D platformers on Switch. So, you know, maybe that's what it's going to take to kind of jumpstart things, is Nintendo reminding kind of the most, I would say the most receptive audience in the world that, oh yes, this is good and fun. You enjoy it. Play these games and we'll make some more for you.
Exactly.
But anyway, yeah, Ape Escape, coming from 1999, is very much a product of its time, and it is a colorful character platform-based mascot action game in 3D. But that's a lot of, that's a lot to say. But it comes from Sony Entertainment,
Sony Computer Entertainment Japan.
It's Sony Studios Japan, which you know, they're kind of all over the place. They make a lot of stuff. And they're probably best known these days for things like Ico and more realistic games like that. But they also, especially at this time, made a lot of kind of vibrant, colorful games, which was very much a thing of the time. You also had Blasto and a few other games around this era from Sony. You know, Parappa the Rapper, the director on, or one of the producers maybe, on Ape Escape, the original, if I'm not mistaken, yes, Takafumi Fujisawa worked on Umjammer Lammy, Parappa the Rapper. He also worked on Siren, so, you know, kind of the opposite end there. He worked on Lifeline, which was, if I'm not mistaken, like an action game. Was that the one where you, like, had the voice control?
Yes, yeah. On the PlayStation 2, where you kind of direct the girl as she goes through the game.
Yep.
And it doesn't work very well.
Nope. And then there was Vib Ripple, the... like a game based around music, and I want to say Vib Ripple was like based around language somehow. I don't know. It was strange. No, that was Mojo Ribbon. Anyway, he's kind of had his hands on a wide variety of games, many of them sort of experimental. Chain Dive was like a Bionic Commando style 3D game where basically you were fighting in midair and had to swing from point to point and could never drop to the ground because there was no ground and you'd die. So he was, he got attached to a lot of wacky stuff. So I think, you know, Ape Escape really kind of shows that multidiscipline tendency that Sony Studios had and has, really. You know, Sony Studios is also the company, that the studio developer that made Kuma Uta, the game about the, like, training a polar bear to be an Enka singer. So, yeah. So it's got that kind of, like, unpredictable wackiness to it. And it's got a great personality. It's very, like I said, vibrant and fun. It controls really well. It has a kind of bouncy fluidity to it, which is so important in a good 3D platformer.
Exactly. And that's largely helped out by what I've come to call the PlayStation wobble, where the way that it renders polygons, you know, they sort of ebb and flow a little bit, and it helps make everything look a little more lively and more fun and more bouncy. And just, like, it's interesting how that little quirk of the PlayStation's means of rendering graphics actually gives a lot more life to the scene and makes everything seem maybe not more real, but more responsive, especially with, you know, in Ape Escape, unlike with Mario, in Mario, you get a star, the star is there, it is stationary, you touch the star. Whereas in Ape Escape, you kind of have these literal moving goalposts as the monkeys respond to your actions and run away from you. And I think it makes it a lot more interesting, and it almost feels like you're kind of outsmarting something. Not that the AI is incredibly intelligent, but the fact that it is able to actively respond to your moves and in later games even use your tools against you, I think that's something that we don't really see a lot of in games nowadays, definitely not at the time.
Yeah, you know, we mentioned the Metal Gear crossover before, but the stealth in this is different from Metal Gear in that Metal Gear, you're really just trying to evade being seen. You're trying to avoid detection and complete a task, you know, complete your mission. Whereas here, your mission is to capture monkeys, but you also want to avoid being seen by them before you capture them. So it's, you know, like a game of tag almost, as opposed to, well, okay, so it's like a game of tag where you're it, as opposed to Metal Gear, where the enemies are it. So it does, exactly. It does have like a reverse kind of flow to it, but that doesn't make the stealth any less challenging, because, you know, a lot of the ways things are set up, like, you know, monkeys are kind of scripted to be in a certain place, and if they spot you, they might attack you, but they might just run away, and then you won't be able to capture them until you take off and they reset and go back to where they were.
Yeah, and you've also got the different personalities for the monkeys indicated by their pants color, which kind of helps you know ahead of time, like, okay, I'm approaching a light blue monkey, it's going to be really aware of me, so I'll actually need to crouch and hide from it. You know, it's a blue monkey, it's going to run away from me very fast, so I need to kind of understand the layout of the level. A green or a black monkey is going to shoot me on sight, which I don't necessarily want either. But then you've got, you know, a yellow monkey is kind of like the default guard in a Metal Gear game. You know, it's not really a challenge or anything. It's more of an obstacle in the way that's really easy to overcome.
Yeah, and you know, you were talking earlier about the vibrancy and the motion. I just looked, and it turns out the second producer on this game, Susumu Takatsuka, kind of cut his teeth at Sega as the motion capture guy for Virtua Fighter, Virtua Fighter 2, and for Fighting Vipers. So he was a guy who was very much kind of on the cutting edge, the pioneering edge of, you know, bringing 3D motion into video games and imbuing polygonal characters with a sense of life. And it really does help you. Like, obviously, this is a very different kind of game than Virtua Fighter, but, you know, you have, like, very lively responses in the monkeys. As you said, they all have kind of their own personalities, and it is more than just, you know, what color of pants are they wearing. Like, they'll perform different taunts at you, or they'll run away and have different expressions if they see you. And, you know, on top of that, you still have that kind of Metal Gear thing where you have the alert phases. In fact, actually, I think this introduced alert phases before Metal Gear did. The Metal Gear Solid came a year before this game, and you basically, like, the enemies either saw you, or they were curious, or they were unaware of you. Whereas Metal Gear Solid 2 introduced, you know, the alert phases where enemies would, you know, be alerted, and then there'd be a countdown. They'd be either like cautious or on the attack, and it would take longer for them, for the timer to go down. I guess, I don't know, was that in Metal Gear Solid? It's all blending together in my senility. But what I'm saying is I feel like this game was, you know, like it kind of drew from those stealth influences and then fed them back into Metal Gear. And, you know, even before that, Sony had worked on Tenchu, which came out, I want to say in 98. And that was very much about stealth and killing as opposed to evasion or capture. So there was definitely something in the air at the time.
Yeah, and I think it's pretty interesting because as we're talking about it, I'm starting to realize you're right. Ape Escape is a lot like Metal Gear because, you know, if you see a single monkey and you alert it, it's not the end of the world or anything. It's not going to alert other monkeys, but in a more crowded space, then it does become a problem because you've got multiple monkeys who are constantly running away from you or trying to attack you. And with the right combination of monkeys, that can be like a fatal error, just like in Metal Gear.
And again, like in Metal Gear, you have a real emphasis on your equipment, your gear. I'm reluctant to call them weapons because it's a very nonviolent game. It's really meant to be sort of an all ages thing. I mean, the entire plot, you're capturing monkeys that are wearing sirens on their heads because a doctor accidentally turned one monkey into an evil genius and he's like trying to take over the world. You know, it's obviously not very serious, but you have all kinds of equipment as opposed to weapons. So like nets and what else do you have? There's like monkey detectors, right?
There's a radar. There's a slingshot, which includes like homing missiles and stuff. You've got the hula hoop, which lets you get around really
right,
fast.
Right, but when you say homing missiles, it's not like you're going to blast the monkeys into jibs.
No.
They're like, you get like knockout gas or stuff, right?
Yeah, you get like a little cartoon explosion, like a red sphere comes out of them. But you're right, they're just knocked onto their butts for a little bit. And you can go in for the catch. You're not hurting them or anything. I don't think it's even possible to knock monkeys off of edges into endless pits or anything.
And in addition to the tools that you can carry around and use to help you capture monkeys as control them, all of these things are controlled, again, with your right stick. You can also get vehicles and things like that, like to go underwater and so forth. So there's a really heavy emphasis on just gadgets and things that you really didn't see in a lot of 3D platformers. They tended to be really pretty much about your character's innate abilities or temporary power-ups, and they tended to be more ephemeral things like, oh, now you can fly, but only for a few minutes, whereas this has not quite the progression of a Metroid-style game, but there is that reliance on tools, and so it really does put a different twist on the 3D platformer. And again, you're using the right analog stick to control these tools. And so it does create a little bit of a need for additional dexterity. Like, you don't have to be the world's most amazing gamer. This is not instant, you know, like single frame parries in Dark Souls or something, but it is a matter of, like if you are swinging a net, the direction you press the right stick is going to determine the angle at which you swing the net. So you need to be careful and kind of have a sense of your right hand's relationship spatially to what you see on the screen. So it does, it adds a little extra element of challenge. It kind of, I would say, moves away from the tendency of games of this era to autocorrect in 3D a lot for you. You know, like you look at Ocarina of Time with the Z targeting, or even a lot of first person shooters had aim correction or like a shot adjustment. Like I'm thinking Dark Forces, Star Wars Dark Forces, where you would shoot at a stormtrooper and your bullet could veer like 15% away from the center of your aim to hit something. You know, they took a lot of liberties. Whereas this doesn't really do that. It's very much about precision, about, you know, being a cautious player, really thinking about your approach to the monkeys and how you're going to sneak up on, you know, a canny monkey who's perched on a rock looking out for you, how you're going to sneak up to them, and then will you be able to execute the catch, and what tools will you use? So there is some sophistication underneath the kind of bubbly plastic surface of this game. And yeah, I feel like it deserves another chance. I feel like people are more sophisticated now. Gamers are more sophisticated, and I feel like the mechanics here would probably go over pretty well.
Yeah, and I've shown Ape Escape, the whole series, to friends of mine who never grew up with it. They were Nintendo kids, and they've also found like the controls are really intuitive in a way that other platformers simply aren't. And, you know, it's just, it's very fun to move your character and to interact with the world in a way that I don't think you get with a lot of other games. I think, again, because of that sort of one-to-one relation that you have. It's kind of like when you're playing Wii Sports and you swing your baseball bat and you hit the baseball, and it just feels good because the character on the screen is doing exactly what you're doing. Here, if I aim my net, it goes exactly where I'm aiming instead of going in the general vicinity of something.
Right. So, yeah, there's something to be said for that level of precision in a sort of all ages platform action game. And I think, you know, maybe if I seem to remember, people tended to be kind of frustrated by it. And I just feel like people are more comfortable with dual analog controllers now. So a big part of this game was kind of getting over that initial hump of introduction to a new gameplay paradigm, basically, like a new interface concept. And now that that's just baked into video games, I feel like it would be a lot more intuitive. But on the other hand, if that's true, like, why didn't Ape Escape 2 and 3 just sell like gangbusters?
I think part of it has to do with the fact that by the time you have those releases on the PlayStation 2, you've seen other games, especially first-person shooters, which are already using the other analog stick as a means of aiming the camera. And I think maybe for some people that's more intuitive in a way. And so kind of unlearning that knowledge of, you know, my right analog stick is my camera, and instead, oh, my right analog stick does the same thing that maybe the trigger or shoulder buttons would do in another game. I think there's that weird kind of backwards barrier for some people, because there aren't games that control like Ape Escape. Ape Escape is very unique in that regard. So if it was your first DualShock game, then that kind of set the standard for you. You kind of just got it. Whereas if it's something that you played later on in life, after playing many other games at the same time, it's just more difficult to kind of get into that headspace.
Actually, let me ask, what did the sequels bring to the series? I haven't really spent much time with 2 or 3, so I'm part of the problem here, I realize, but I really don't know what those games represented, aside from just like, hey, now you know what a DualShock controller is. Here is a cute, colorful game. Please try to love it, even though you just played Grand Theft Auto 3 and everything has changed now.
Well, as I was revisiting the series, going from Ape Escape 1 to Ape Escape 2 in particular, it's a very drastic jump for a thing that I didn't really expect. When you play Ape Escape, I don't know if you've experienced this, but while there is that direct control, it's a little bit off. It's not as immediate as you might want. Whereas with Ape Escape 2 and Ape Escape 3, your movement is a lot more fluid, and you've got more moves with your gadgets that make it easier to kind of correct for those mistakes. I'm not sure if it's in Ape Escape 2, but in Ape Escape 3, let's say I swing with my net and I miss, I can then move the stick to the side and I'll do kind of like a side sweep. And it's interesting. It's such a small thing, but it adds a lot to the gameplay, and it just makes it a lot easier to go back to. Like, Ape Escape 1 isn't really a game that I look forward to replaying just because of those control quirks. But
so it has like canned animations, basically?
I guess, but even things like the run cycle in Ape Escape 1, Spike kind of, he walks like a Charlie Brown or a Peanuts character, you know? It's a very stilted walk cycle, whereas in the other games, it's a lot more fluid and it's more immediate and you're faster, which is very helpful when you're trying to catch certain monkeys. But you've also got in Ape Escape 2, which I think is kind of the black sheep of the series, but apparently it's most people's favorite. You've got the addition of Peepochi, which is a little baby angel monkey that is with you for most of the game, and he acts as kind of a bit of a handicap, I guess, if you will. If you fall in a pit, he'll save you. If you don't quite make a jump, he'll help you make it. If you go down, he'll give you more cookies so that you don't lose a life. And then in Ape Escape 3, you've got the introduction of the morph system, which gives you these different kind of anime archetypes, which give you new abilities. So you can turn into a knight, and you have a magic spell that you can cast, but also a shield, or you become a cowboy and you've got little pop guns, and you're able to shoot kind of a projectile net, things like that. But Ape Escape 2 in particular, you've got a couple new gadgets, but it's not a huge departure from the series.
Hmm. Okay. Well,
the series of one up to that point.
So it kind of sounds like 2 was a pretty significant leap forward in terms of playability, but they didn't really have a lot of new things to say with the game necessarily?
No, not really. You've got some new gadgets. I'm trying to think. One of them is kind of like an extending arm,
like an Ultra Hand?
Yes, exactly, the Ultra Hand, which acts as like a little punching glove that you can use to hit the monkeys, but it doesn't really do anything that your stun club couldn't do already. I think you use it for a couple of buttons maybe, but why did that have to be there? Why couldn't it have just been the stun club still? Whereas in Ape Escape 3, you don't have any new gadgets. It's all about these new morphs, which some of them are in the same boat as the Ultra Hand kind of thing, where, you know, the Kung Fu morph, you use it to punch a button with a dragon on it, and that's it. But then some of them are at least more interesting. They give you new means of moving around, or of capturing monkeys, or of maneuvering these different situations, some of which are set up, but some of which you're able to kind of craft and maneuver on your own.
All right. So there are some differences between the various games, but it doesn't explain why the series just kind of went away after 2005 and Ape Escape 3. And I guess by went away, I mean they stopped making platformers and just said, hey, here's some party games. Here's, you know, a minigame collection. They had like Ape Escape Academy. And I guess, you know, in fairness, they did try to bring the series back and try to give it new life by taking it to PSP. I remember Ape Escape on the Move, a remake of the original game, was a PSP launch window title.
Ape Escape on the Loose.
Oh, on the Loose. Okay.
It was at launch, but as I'm sure you'll remember with the PSP, it has one analog nub, not two. And so you lose a lot of the charm of Ape Escape when, instead of, you know, having that stick, wow, direct movement, direct action, instead you push the face button, and it does it in the general vicinity of where you're facing. And so you take Ape Escape and you make it completely unremarkable by taking away, I think, the thing that makes it so great. And when I play On the Loose, it's like, I might as well go play Mario.
Yes, you just summed up my review of the game for 1UP.com. I basically said, you know, this game was designed to show off the dual analog stick. So why are they using it as a launch title to showcase a platform that doesn't have dual analog controls? It's just highlighting what they didn't include in the PSP, even though everyone was like, why doesn't this have two sticks? It should. So yeah, a huge, huge mistake. But they did bring a bunch of the games to PSP, and I don't know that necessarily found any more traction there. But it seems like Ape Escape was just kind of like the property that they rolled out from time to time when they had like, hey, we want to dabble in this genre or make use of this tech. So that's what happened, was they trotted out Ape Escape and worked it into something else. But none of those things were classic platformers.
Yeah, it's a lot like Fantastic Four, where we only get a movie every once in a while to, you know, keep the property and keep using it so that they can put it back on the shelf for a couple of years, only to then trot it out a little while later and disappoint us again.
Huh, that's an interesting comparison. I would not have thought to have compared Ape Escape to Fantastic Four. But sure, yes, I agree. Fantastic Four deserves better, by God. Yeah, so anyway, are there any of the spinoffs that you actually love? Like, are there any that you go back to, or are they just kind of like, oh, that exists?
I wouldn't say there are any that I love. There are some that I played as an adolescent. Ape Quest comes to mind, which is a spinoff RPG party game hybrid.
That's a strange confluence of things.
Yeah, it's not very good, and it was one of the earlier uses of, I guess you'd call them expansion passes on the PSP, where you had like these three main story routes. Each of them was like $7, and if you want the whole game, well, you got to get all of them. But yeah, it wasn't a very good game, but as I was going back to the series and playing all of these games again, I found one that I hadn't ever experienced when I was younger, which was Ape Escape Pumped and Primed on the PS2, which is a party game. However, unlike Ape Academy, where you have these mini games that have nothing to do with Ape Escape except for the monkeys, with Pumped and Primed, you have kind of this 1v1v1v1 kind of free-for-all, I guess, arena-style. Like Mario Kart's battle mode sort of system, where you are using the actual gadgets from Ape Escape and you control the game like you do Ape Escape, but you're presented with these really interesting scenarios that you don't get in the main series. So, for example, you'll have a challenge where you're trying to collect coins, like in Super Smash Bros.' coin mode, but you're using RC cars to maneuver around and damage and stun your opponents so that you can go and get more coins than they can. And it's not what I would have thought to do with the property, but the fact that it is still using the mechanics from the games makes it really easy to just jump into if you're familiar with the series, because I'm not learning new controls for how to do a rhythm game or anything. I'm just playing Ape Escape, but against other people.
Interesting. But there aren't any that you're like, oh yes, this is it. This is what Ape Escape should be. They got it. They nailed it.
No, I think Ape Escape should be Ape Escape and not these spinoffs.
All right. So final question. If you were to bring back Ape Escape, if Shuhei Yoshida was like, Joseph, my friend, we need you to come and save Ape Escape for us. Bring it back. Make it a hit. What would that be?
I think what it would be, it would mostly be based on Ape Escape 3. So I would keep a lot of the morphs. I would get rid of kind of a lot of the redundant ones. But in Ape Escape 3, you go to different TV channels. And so you get to explore these different set pieces. But I would do the same thing, but with different video games, because I think you've got a little more leeway there, but it would be in keeping with the rest of Ape Escape's kind of irreverence and quirkiness. But if I'm already catching monkeys, why not have sort of like a Pokemon parody in there? I think something like that would allow for a better exploration of the mechanics. And since they've already dabbled in so many other genres already, it would very much be in keeping with the rest of the series.
So you would be in like some sort of thinly veiled God of War parody with like a boomerang axe net that you'd throw and
exactly
and capture monkeys.
Okay. And there would be a Dark Souls level.
Of course, why wouldn't there be? Okay, that sounds interesting. Yeah, I could see that. It would give them the chance to dabble in a few different gameplay styles, maybe incorporate some of those varied mechanics, and do that kind of pop culture parody that they love so much. I remember, wasn't there like a monkey like from outer space or in a UFO or something named Mulder? They did a lot of stuff like that.
Yeah, there are countless pop culture references in Ape Escape.
Yeah, at this point, I feel like you know, in 20 years, video games have matured a lot and kind of developed their own vocabulary and developed their own culture. So there is space for that. I like this idea. You need to write to Mr. Yoshida and say, dude, I got it. I'm going to save Ape Escape for you. You didn't know you needed this, but you do, and I've got it.
I'm sure the only thing they've needed this whole time was an ideas person.
Yes, that's it. Those are so rare. There's so few of them in the world. All right, well, I think that's probably, like, I can't think of anything more to say about Ape Escape. Can you?
No, not entirely, except for maybe the soundtracks.
Okay, yeah.
Yeah, with Ape Escape 1, what I find baffling is that they brought in a drum and bass producer. They brought in Soichi Terada, who, you know, is kind of one of the pioneers of Japanese house music and jungle music. And I think his touch lends a lot to the sound design because it doesn't sound like video game music. When I play Mario and I listen to Mario music, it's Mario music. Whereas when I play Ape Escape and I listen to the soundtrack, it's the sort of thing that I would be listening to in, you know, while I'm working or something, or while I'm reading a book. And it just sounds like regular music. And I think that that's really valuable. I was reading a little bit about this, and the director or one of the producers for Ape Escape, Masamichi Seki, apparently heard Soichi Terada's sort of breakout album Sumo Jungle, which is a mix of drum and bass and jungle with traditional Japanese music. And he was so sort of taken with it that he offered Terada the opportunity to make the soundtrack. And I think he did a pretty bang up job. And then it kind of like LSD Dream Emulator, which was composed by Osamu Sato, the music just stands up on its own, and it doesn't seem, it's not necessarily connected to the gameplay experience, but it definitely makes it a lot better in a way that, you know, I don't think you get with other games. And then with Ape Escape 2, they decided to change composers entirely. They brought in Koji Hayama, who most famously did the soundtrack for Chōaniki. And then it's not bad music, but it goes back to sounding like video game music. But thankfully, they kind of saw the light, I suppose. And with Ape Escape 3, you've got Soichi Terada back again, and he starts repurposing some of his previous work outside of the video game sphere and repurposes it for the video game space in a way that I feel is, it's very unique to the Ape Escape experience, and it produced some soundtracks that I am still listening to regularly.
I've never really paid that much attention to the series music, but yeah, that was a core strength of Sony during the PS1 days, is they really leveraged their connection with music roots. I mean, PS1 kind of emerged from their relationship with Nintendo, where they made a sound chip for the Super NES, and they had Sony Records, so they had access to this huge stable of composers and musicians. So yeah, you had games like Parappa the Rapper, and you had games like Tenchu, which I mentioned earlier, and those just had amazing soundtracks, like nothing else in gaming. And yeah, this was, I think it's easy to kind of disregard it because it's so cutesy, but as you mentioned it, yeah, like it didn't have a cutesy style. It was very sort of rhythmic and kind of, you know, like a groove, as opposed to, hey, let's go catch some monkeys. Like you didn't get that like Calliope feel to it. And, you know, I think people kind of associate that like, oh, it's going to sound like Mario music. And it took a long time for Mario music to stop sounding like Mario music and become grandiose. Like, hey, now it's orchestrated. Now it's, you know, it's like ragtime. But that took a while to get there. And Sony was way ahead of Nintendo and really everyone in that regard. So yeah, good call.
Yeah, I think that's largely helped by having the CD format, whereas when you listen to Banjo-Kazooie soundtrack, it's very good. Grant Kirkhope did a very good job, but it's not CD quality.
Right. Well, that has a lot to do with the shortcomings of the N64 and the fact that it didn't have a sound processor whatsoever. But that's a conversation for a different time. But yes, There will be lots of music edited into this episode, so people will have kind of a living demonstration of the music by the time they've heard all this. So that's good. They can hear us now talking and say, ah, yes, they are wise, recognizing this music and the quality that we have just heard. So hopefully everyone has enjoyed this conversation about a largely overlooked little corner of video gaming. Joseph, thank you for suggesting it and for coming on the show to give kind of a fan's eye perspective, a knowledgeable perspective on the Ape Escape series. I appreciate it. So with that said, where can people find you on the internet? Do you have anything that people can read or follow you on social media, or what's the deal?
I would prefer to be like a ghost in the wind and remain as anonymous as possible. So,
well, you've already told us your name, so wow. Anonymity only goes so far. But yeah, if you don't want to pimp anything or push any work, that's cool too.
No, I don't. But thank you very much for having me.
Yeah, well, thank you very much for supporting Retronauts and for, again, helping me to create content for everyone's enjoyment. So no one knows where you can find Joseph on the internet, but Retronauts you can find at patreon.com/retronauts. And I don't know if there are any openings right now, but if you would like to be on an episode, there is a tier on Patreon called One of the Livestream, and you can angle in there and be here on the show talking about your favorite game or a game that you absolutely hate. I don't care. Either way, it's going to be an interesting conversation. So again, thanks, Joseph. And we'll be back after this break with another topic. I don't know what it's going to be yet, but by the time this episode comes out, it won't be a mystery because it will be in the title. Yes, that's correct.
Rank and Vile is a podcast dedicated to ranking every horror movie ever made from best to worst. Every single one of them. Each episode, we add a couple more to our list of hundreds and then justify why we think Killer Clowns from Outer Space is a better movie than Dead Ringers. No, really, that did actually end up happening. Check us out on the Greenlit Podcast Network, where you can find a new episode every Wednesday.
Spaceships,
magic swords,
intergalactic empires,
dead gods,
and creatures from beyond the moon.
What mad universe could contain all these fantastic visions? What Mad Universe is a bi-weekly podcast delving into the misty origins of sci-fi and fantasy, pop culture and genre tropes.
Take a cosmic trip on What Mad Universe Podcast
on the Greenlit Podcast Network.
Hey everybody, this is Andrew from Superhero Stuff You Should Know, and we are proud to be the latest addition to the Greenlit Podcast Network.
If you're a superhero fan, our show will put your knowledge to the test. Did you know Tim Burton almost made a Batman musical?
Or how Superman almost had a love story with his own cousin?
That's disgusting.
But it's true.
We cover it all, mixing clips with commentaries, sketches, and impersonations.
So tune in to Superhero Stuff You Should Know, available on iTunes, Spotify, and YouTube, and everywhere you get your podcasts.
This is Super Nintendads.
You know I don't like Dr. Mario. I think he's a fraud back alley doctor.
Am I very happy to be here?
With the help of a doula, you can do anything in the tub.
You're looking at the Nintendo knitting machine!
Do you feel that I abused you by making you play Night Trap?
I challenge you guys to a dance-off at McDonald's tomorrow's.
What have I done, Sweet Jesus? What have I done?
Super Nintendads Entertainment Podcast. Every week right here on Greenlit.
Hey everyone, welcome to another episode of Retronauts. I'm Jeremy Parrish, and with me this week, adjacent to the Long Island Retro Gaming Expo, I have a special guest, Mr. Leonard Herman.
Hello.
he's a man of many words, although you may not believe it based on his intro. But yeah, Lynn has been writing about video game history for as long as I've cared about video game history.
Right. I wrote the first book on video game history back in 1994. That was Phoenix, The Fall and Rise of Home Video Games. And I've been doing it ever since. So next year will be 25 years since the first edition came out.
Yeah, so, you know, back in the 90s, people weren't really too concerned with where video games had been. They were mostly focused on where they were going. And even, you know, what was available at the time was not enough. There had to be more. We had to get polygons and get better graphics. And, you know, you had Next Generation Magazine. So, you know, a book focused entirely on everything that had come before since the 60s and 70s. I don't know, even before that, it's been a while since I've read Phoenix. How far back do you go with your research?
Well, the newest edition goes back to about 1947.
Okay.
With the mainframe computers, mm-hmm. the tic-tac-toe on the mainframe computer. The first edition went back to the Abacus, but a publisher who was interested in the book said take out the computer history chapter because the book doesn't cover computer games, so
that
I
makes
followed
sense.
Their advice.
Yeah, but I really feel like you sort of paved the way for shows like this. I'm sure eventually people would have started saying, oh, where did this video game come from? And, you know, around the time that you published your book, I was starting to kind of step back and say, well, you know, I have a Super Nintendo and eventually I'm going to get a Nintendo Project Reality and maybe a PlayStation, but those old NES games are actually still kind of fun. Like, I got rid of my NES, but I kind of regret it. I kind of want to go back and play some of those games. And so that kind of got me started thinking about, you know, what had been left behind and where, you know, the sequels that we were playing, where they came from. Donkey Kong Country was coming out, mm-hmm. and it made me think about, you know, playing Donkey Kong in the arcades. So I feel like you were just kind of a few steps ahead there and already kind of made the connections and said, well, let's talk about that. So,
well, I have a column in the magazine, Old School Gamer Magazine, and it's called The Game Scholar, which was a name that Electronic Gaming Monthly magazine gave me back in around 2002. But a subtitle of the column is now calls me the father of gaming history, because people said to me, well, you did start all this. All these shows came on the back of that. So I said, well, I'll run with that. But I wrote a book that wasn't available at the time. It was something I was interested in. There were some books out that had a chapter on video game history, but it was very brief, and I wanted more. And at that time, there was no internet like we have now. You couldn't find this information anywhere unless you really, really dug for it. The book itself, I never planned to write a history book on video games. I've always been a collector when I was a kid. Matchbox cars, comic books. And when I became an adult, that carried over into that. When I got my first Atari VCS, I had to buy every single game for it. And that's,
was this early on in the VCS's life, or was it, you
second
know,
year?
Okay.
I bought mine.
So there was still, that was still a reasonable goal, like buying all the games. It wasn't like there were 300.
I got mine in May 1979.
Okay.
And within a year, there were several dozen out. And so I went to school for writing. I've always been a writer. And so I said, there's so many games. I said, why don't I write a guide to all these different games so people know the difference between them? So I wrote a book. I started writing a book called ABC to the VCS, which was a directory to all the games that were out for the Atari VCS at the time. And I started writing that book around 1982. The problem with a book like that is it never ends. So I think I'm finished, but there's more games coming out. So I had to start attending CES, Consumer Electronics Shows, to see what was coming out. I started acquiring the press kits for all the advanced games and stuff. And then the crash came in 1984. Well, 1983, but 1984 is when everything started really falling apart. And I knew that there was going to be no interest in this book at all anymore. So I killed the book. And 1985, the NES came out. So I'm thinking, well, maybe I should do ABC to the NES. But I just couldn't. I wasn't a fan of Nintendo, for one. And I just couldn't stomach getting all the games for the system. So I abandoned that idea. But I still wanted to write a book about video games. I was thinking, well, what can I write about? And then thinking I have all this information for, you know, I have books that have game history in them. I have all these press kits. Why don't I write a book about the history of video games? Because one doesn't exist. So around 1987, I started that. And initially, I was going to write chapter by chapter was going to be about different companies. Like the first chapter would be about Atari. Second chapter would be about Mattel. Third chapter would be about Nintendo. And the problem with that was a lot of the chapters were beginning to overlap. There was information that would be in one chapter would also be another chapter. And I said, this isn't going to work. And that's when I came up with the idea to do a chronological approach to it. So my book goes year by year from the beginning to what's current. Back then it was, the book went up to 1992, I believe. My plan was for the book to be published in 1992, which would have been the 20th anniversary of Pong and the Odyssey. Unfortunately, the publishers didn't see the same, didn't have the same vision I had. I have rejection slips from companies saying the industry's too new. It's only 20 years old. There's really, it's too new to have a history. And so, and I must have four or five rejection slips. So the book was done, and I didn't know what to do with it at that time because no publisher was interested in it. And there was a fanzine out at the time called the 2600 Connection, which covered Atari 2600 games. So I wrote a letter to them, and I mentioned my books, ABC, the VCS, and Phoenix. And the response to that was overwhelming. People said, well, why don't I want to read this book. I want to read this book. So I decided to Xerox copies of it. Very small microscopic print. It was... The book was in portrait mode, page on each side, folded over and stapled. And I made 50 copies of that, and I started sending it out to fanzines and stuff. But then EGM 2 came out. That was EGM was doing so well, they decided to have a magazine to come out 2 weeks after the regular magazine. So they're basically a
Yeah, it was like a bi-weekly publication, yeah.
Yeah, I was going to say bi-monthly, but that's every other one.
Semi-monthly.
Yeah, so every 2 weeks they had a magazine come out. And in the second issue, Chris Johnson, who did have a fanzine out, he got a job with EGM, and he wrote a review of Phoenix. And it was a great review. And I decided I cannot sell this little paperback thing I was printing. And then I learned about self-publishing. Mm-hmm. So I went ahead, created my own company, Relenta Press, and self-published the book. And that's the story of the first edition.
Okay. I didn't realize Relenta Press was just you. Yes. You know, I have Phoenix, like the first edition with the Relenta Press. Mm-hmm. And I think the yellow cover with red text. Yeah. So maybe that's second edition. I don't know.
No, that's the second one. Okay. With the TV screen on it.
That's my great artwork.
That shows how talented I am. Now, the first one just said Phoenix and nothing else.
Right. But yeah, I mean, I saw that, and that kind of, that sparked something for me because I was like, well, I've never heard of Relenta Press. So it must be like, you know, a small vanity press.
Well, the funny thing about that is when I was trying to find a publisher, I saw there was a publisher called Digital Press, which is in northern New Jersey, mm-hmm. which is where I am. I said, they'd be perfect. I didn't know it was a fanzine.
Right. But, yeah, it was a big name for a small organization.
So, but Relenta Press is a combination of my name. Oh, my son's name, Ronnie. That's where the R-O comes from.
Oh, okay.
The Len is me, L-E-N. And then my wife's name is Tamar, so that's where the T-A came from. And I have a second son, Gregory, who wasn't born until 2 years later, so he wasn't included. Sorry, Greg.
So it's interesting that eventually ABC to the VCS did make it out.
Right.
I have a copy of that, and I didn't realize it dates all the way back to 1982 in some conceptual form.
It goes back
form.
To 1982. And again, the same people who read 2600 Connection asked for that too. So that one I did come out with this folded paperback with this. It should come with a magnifying glass, but it didn't. And that came out in...
Just like reading sports statistics in the paper.
So that came out in 1995. And then in 2005, I did a second edition, mm-hmm. which was a slick, you know,
red paperback. Yeah, that's what I have, okay. Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah, there is one before that.
Okay. Interesting. So there's even more history here than I realized. But it, you know, kind of what you're talking about with the video game market crash and everything, that does kind of line up with, you know, just the way things sort of generally flowed. I feel like that was a huge setback for anything connected to the console industry in America. Yeah.
But then it was only America, too.
Right. But just in America. Sometimes. Yeah. Yeah. We're pretty good about recognizing that on the show, I think. We know there's more to the world than just the U.S. console market. But it's interesting that you didn't like Nintendo. Is that just something that was at the time, or do you still kind of shy away from Nintendo?
I just felt that they were bullies with their, you know, everyone had to buy. The manufacturer, the gaming developers, had to go to Nintendo to manufacture the cartridges. And they're so stringent about how many games they're going to produce. And I just didn't like that.
So even at the time, you were aware of those stipulations on the market. Okay.
And I don't think, maybe in the beginning, their purpose was to get, you know, keep the bad stuff off. But they never followed that. So.
Yeah, I mean, yeah. In theory, it's good. Although, if you look at the Famicom market in Japan, there was a lot of absolute crap that could have made it over here and didn't. So I think at the beginning, at least, there was definitely a filter happening. And even though some of those early third-party and first-party games are kind of like, they were still a lot better than some of the swill that was floating around in the Japanese market at the time. So I think that was okay. But now at this point, that's pretty much the standard model. Like what they did was kind of standardized. So for better or for worse, and that's just kind of, I guess, how the business works.
But I never even got an NES back then. I mean, I was a big, huge Atari fan. So I had the 2600. I got the 7800. Never got a 5200. I had the Atari 800 computer, which was what I wrote both books on. In fact, I bought an Atari 800 for word processing. I figure if I'm writing a book about Atari, it should be on an Atari 800 or Atari computer.
System, yeah.
I knew nothing about computers then. Eventually I taught myself BASIC and became a programmer after that. But so I used the Atari word processor, which was this every page was a file. And then years later, they came out with Atari Writer, which was a cartridge that went to the system. So I had to convert all the files from Atari word processor into Atari Writer. So every page as a file had to be imported. And then finally, I had a file. Then when I entered the PC age, I had to find a way how to get my Atari files onto the PC. And that was a problem.
Because they used different diskette standards, right?
Yeah.
There was no USB in those days.
No USB.
No simple plug-and-play universal solution.
Nothing like that. Someone said there was a way you could hook a serial cable up to one. Mm-hmm. I don't even know. But I had CompuServe. And CompuServe had an online section where you can store files. So I figured I could load all my files up to CompuServe from the 800 and then download them onto my 286 PC. But I still had to get them from Atari Writer format into text. Well, they came out with Atari Writer Plus, which was disk-based, and that had a feature to convert to text. The only problem, because it was disk-based, you needed the disk operating system in there, too, which took up a lot of the memory that the cartridge didn't need. So all my files, when I used Atari Writer 2, were cut. So I had to go back to Atari Writer, take every one of my files, and split them into two. Then I had to go to Atari Writer, and I loaded them onto CompuServe at a whopping 300 bits a minute or something, really slow. Mm-hmm. And then download them at a speedy 1,200 bits to the PC. This was really, really time-consuming. Mm-hmm. It was about a 300-page book in both books. But finally, I got them down, used Professional Write on the PC end, converted, and then finally I was able to put it out. And then WordPerfect came out. WordPerfect, I never understood how to use WordPerfect on the PC. I used Professional Write, which I thought was an easy program. But they came out with a WordPerfect 6, which was a WYSIWYG. And I said, oh, this is cool because I could see what the screens are going to look like. So I converted everything into WordPerfect 6, and that's what the book was finally published from. Okay. But if you go through the book, there's a lot of formatting mistake. It goes to the the text, the font changes from one place to another. So,
yeah, it's something that I feel like that was kind of the charm of dealing with tech in the old times. Even though maybe at the old times, you know, back when we were younger, like it didn't seem fun at the time, but now you look back and you're like, wow, we really accomplished a lot making all these different connections that were never intended and figuring out how to get things from one format to another. And, you know, I've gotten into, capturing footage from, of games from original hardware. And that has been an ordeal to like get all everything, you know, to get RGB output of everything and then feed it into a common system and make sure all the RGB, yeah, like they're syncing up the right way. And, you know, it's all the same format and everything. It's just a huge hassle. And, you know, now that we have standards like USB and HDMI, we kind of take things for granted. You just plug something in and it works.
But one thing I love about
it was not the way it was.
I love about USB is that Joe DeCour was one of the inventors of it.
And yeah?
And he was one of the designers of the Atari 400-800. And those computers you can daisy chain together.
Mm-hmm.
Every peripheral you just plug in. And I remember when I went to the computer and you had these serial cables and stuff. It was a problem to me. So when USB came out, that was saving grace.
So, yeah, looking back at the Atari days, you know, the 2600 days, were there any games that you found particularly inspiring? Or was it just kind of like a general feeling like, I need to write about these? Was there any one game you wanted to, like, evangelize?
I loved Adventure when it came out. I loved Superman when that came out. That came out before Adventure. I thought this was really, really cool because you have multiple screens. And I like logic games, and those two fall into that category without being simple puzzles. Mm-hmm. And I like that. Didn't like the sports games on the 2600. And then finally when the Real Sports series came out, well, now that made my book more important because since I'm talking about every game, I have a chapter on sports, and I start with Home Run and then go to Real Sports Baseball and Super Challenge Baseball and tell, you know, what the games are about. I mean, ABC to VCS I'm talking about. So, yeah, some games I didn't like, but they still stood out. I was telling my friend Patrick, the slot machine, and I was saying that was like one of the most stupidest games you can get. Like, even Casino, you're not playing with real money, but at least you can practice your skills at Blackjack.
Mm-hmm.
Where, what do you get out of a slot machine? You're not getting any money from it. It's totally random, and you're just pressing a button. I thought that was like one of the most useless
it's
games.
It's like a Skinner ever. Box or something. Like there's no real...
There's no purpose to it.
Yeah, interactivity to it.
Yeah. And that was one of the first games that they discontinued, which I was happy about. Yeah, so there were some pretty bad games for that.
I'm sure it had great cover art, though. I'm sure it was like this gorgeous, like, airbrushed, you know,
but had a real
scene
slot machine
of Las Vegas. Yeah.
Yeah.
Like a pretty woman in an elegant dress, like playing a slot machine or something. I can just imagine what the box art was like. But then the reality of the game, I'm sure it was just, you know, like
the game. And they didn't even use the standard symbols on the. I don't even remember what the symbols were in the game, but they weren't real slot machine symbols.
Okay,
so I was like a big Breakout fan, and Breakout's what inspired me to get to the VCS. I had a friend who worked at Crazy Eddie, which was a major. Electronic manufacturer in New York in the 80s. And I had a friend who worked for them, and he said I could use his discount to get a system. So I couldn't decide between the Odyssey 2 and the VCS. And I liked the Odyssey 2 because it had the keyboard. I thought that was pretty cool. But the VCS had Breakout. And so that sold me on it. So when I bought my VCS, I bought Casino because it was a limited edition. Who knew what that meant? Breakout, and then of course it came out with Combat. Then Super Breakout came out, and I thought that was a good, great game. And there were some pretty good games. Space Invaders was really good on the 2600.
Mm-hmm.
I thought the people disagree. I thought Defender came out pretty well on the 2600. I mean, of course, it's not like the real game, but it's close enough. Activision, practically everything Activision did were great games. But the funny thing is, I bought not the flashback hardware, which I have all those, but they also came with software for the Xbox One and the PS4, 50 games. And I said, oh, I could play my, you know, against my kids. And I was finding that the games were pretty boring.
Yeah, it's hard for me to go back to Atari 2600. Like, I saw my friends had a 2600, and I envied it, but we didn't actually own one, so I kind of really cut my teeth with ColecoVision and NES.
ColecoVision I never got into for some reason.
Well, ColecoVision I thought was pretty solid. Mm-hmm. We ended up getting that because, you know, the market crash, and my parents wanted a computer for our home, so they were like, well, we'll get a Coleco Atom
because
it's cheaper than, you know, getting an Apple II or something, or a Commodore 64, because it was on clearance. They
literally
just wanted to get it out. Yeah. So that was kind of my introduction to computing at home, was Coleco Atom, and that was okay, but I could never get my, like, the Atari programs from magazines, you know, Atari 800 programs that I would find in magazines.
Oh, yeah, Apple, well, Antic Apple programs. And Analog, they were great magazines.
Yeah, like, I would type in these programs, and they wouldn't work, and I was like, well, that's no good.
Well, that's the thing. Atari had its own subset of BASIC. Mm-hmm. They didn't use the pure BASIC language. And I found it difficult when I went and tried getting a job as a BASIC programmer, because I didn't know real BASIC. I knew the Atari BASIC. And there were a lot of differences in it.
Yeah, I would, you know, type in peek and poke commands without realizing, well, that's Apple II specific.
Well, that's like, exactly the same thing I had.
No, I'm not getting anything out of my Coleco Atom with that. But it is, you know, kind of just a representation of
Atari BASIC did use peek and poke.
Oh, did it? Well,
yeah.
Right, but I was talking about the Coleco.
I don't think regular BASIC used peek and poke.
Okay,
I remember going for an interview at Prudential for a BASIC job, and I'm talking about peek and poke, how I use them to put as storage areas, you know, and they're what's that?
Right. Old times.
The good days.
Yeah. So talking more about the books, how was the reception to the first volume of Phoenix? Like, once you actually got it published, I feel like I saw it mentioned, you know, online and
well, the reception was good, especially, I mean, EGM2, once they, you know, mentioned it. Electronic Games Magazine did a full-page review on it. All the magazines were covering it, which was great. The problem was it wasn't in stores, because it was self-published. So that was my biggest problem. But one great story I had is my brother-in-law was a graduate student at Stanford. And it was the end of the year, and he had to go to his office to get something. So he parked his car on the street, ran into his office. He runs out, and there's a guy who's walking, not looking where he's going, walking, looking down at a book. And it was Phoenix. And my brother goes, my brother-in-law wrote that. So I heard that story. I just, wow, this is great.
So it was mail order only, basically?
Yeah. I got a P.O. box. Mm-hmm. So that's the way you had to get it. So a lot of people didn't know about it. People stores did order. Borders placed a lot of special orders for
okay.
me. Mm-hmm. Barnes & Noble, not as much. So I used to go to my P.O. box, and there's another border order. I was like, oh, it's great. It did well. And when I decided to do the second edition, again, I didn't go for a publisher because I just liked handling everything myself. And the second edition did well, too, even though it was only 2.5 more chapters. But I had pictures, so that changed things. And then the third edition, I felt the same way. You know, well, I need a publisher. This is fun doing it myself. And the third edition, I wasn't happy with at all. I went with a different printer. I made the book 8.5 by 11 size because I thought this was, you know, these pictures could be bigger. And the printer I used, it looked like they used toilet paper for the cover. All the covers folded, plus the book was huge and unwieldy. So I wanted to get a real publisher for the fourth edition.
Yeah, and the fourth edition came out last year. Is that right?
The black and white one came out in December of 2016.
Right.
And then the color one came out in July of 2017.
Okay.
And I had a publisher for that. I sent them the third edition so they know what's in it. They were interested. We signed a contract and everything. And then I start sending them chapters, and then they turn around and says, we want you to change this. We want you to change. They want me to rewrite the book from scratch, and I didn't want to do that. So then the publisher says, we have a new editor. She's a gamer. the problem is she could be a gamer, but she has no game history, so right. that's not going to help editing a book like this. But I quietly just kept writing the book, and when I wanted to get out of the contract, and it was a one-way contract, I couldn't get out of it. Only they could cancel it, so I was screwed. So when I finally finished it, I sent it to them, and they turned around and said, we tried to tell you to change this and this and this, and sorry, we're going to have to cancel the contract. And I'm like, yeah. But they, again, they did say to get rid of the first chapter on computer history. I listened to that. One thing they wanted was the chapters to break them into sub-chapters and with subtitles. I thought that was a good idea. Mm-hmm. I did that. I don't even remember anymore the stuff that they wanted me to do that I didn't agree with. And to this day, even though I don't remember what they were, I still don't agree with it. So then I tried getting other publishers, and I went to an educational publisher, a big educational publisher. We got past the peer review section, and they were interested. And that's when I discovered about CreateSpace and Amazon. Mm-hmm. And I said, well, you know, if I do through them, it'll definitely go on Amazon. So I told that publisher, you know, I'm going to just do it myself. And I was going to go proceed. Oh, and then what really sold me, I have a favorite mystery writer named Lawrence Block. And he's publishing books through through CreateSpace. And I said to him, why do you do this? You can get any publisher you want. And he said, no, I like the convenience. I like the supply the books right away. They're manufactured very well. And that sold me. But then a friend of mine said, try McFarland Press. That's the press that Brett Weiss used. Mm-hmm. And now Pat Hickey Jr. just used his. Why don't you try them? So for the hell of it, I sent them a query. And they were very interested. They wanted to send me a contract. But she's worried about the amount of pictures I had, whether I can use them. And I can use them. She wanted the name of the book changed, and I agreed with that. I mean, Phoenix, The Fall and Rise of Video Games really doesn't mean anything anymore.
Right.
Especially, I mean, when it came out in 1994, the crash was the central point of the book. We're 10 years past the crash, which was 10 years past the beginning of the industry. Mm-hmm. So that was the,
right.
the central point.
Sort of
so
a
the
rise anchor and fall. Point, yeah.
So I said, yeah, that makes sense. I'll get rid of the name. But I wanted to keep Phoenix in there somehow because people know that name. And that's when I finally came up with Phoenix 4, the history of the video game industry. Actually, I had a contest for people to help me with the subtitle. But anyway, so they wanted me to change the name. I agreed with that. But their terms were horrible. Like Pat Hickey's book that just came out, they make very nice books. But his book is a 200-page book, and it retails for $40.
Wow.
So if his book is going to retail for $40 for 200 pages, what's mine 800-page book going to cost? I said, no one's going to pay $100 for a book. I just couldn't see that. And one thing they do is they deal a lot with libraries. I mean, they don't have books in bookstores, so that's what I want, get book in bookstores. Right. So they don't do that, so I don't need that for that. Need them for that. I could do Amazon myself, but they do libraries. So we tried going to, well, how about we do a split edition? You handle the library trade, and I'll handle the commercial trade. No, we have a standard contract. We don't deviate from that. So that's when I decided to go ahead and do the fourth edition on my own.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I've used CreateSpace, and there's ups and downs with it. Yeah. Like yesterday, someone brought a book, one of my books, to our panel, and I looked at it, and it started on page 7. Like, they had just forgotten to publish pages 1 through 6. Oh, I was like, God. Oh, I wish you had written to me about this, because that's not how this is supposed to be. And they'll replace stuff, but you have to actually say, hey, I don't think this book is supposed to start on page
right.
7.
Yeah, the customer service is excellent.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, it's Amazon, so it's mistake-prone, but they're also good about saying, whoops, we goofed. Sorry, that's on us. So, yeah, it's pretty good. The pricing is kind of in between. It's yeah. not like as good as it could be, but it's definitely not $100 per book. So yeah, I think that's a pretty good solution. And like you said, it is an 800-page book. So I didn't even know they actually went up that high. I thought they topped out at like
828 pages.
So that's the max.
And that's what the book went to. Just totally coincidence, I used 828 pages. I didn't plan that, but my problem with them was for the hardcover edition. They don't do hardcover right. at all. And their color, they only do up to 400 pages or 450
okay,
pages.
Yeah, yeah.
So I was trying to think, well, maybe I'll split the books in half. But once the color one went to 860 pages, there was really no way to do it. So I had to go with Ingram, which is a book distributor. And the book's really nice, the color edition, except I have to warn people now, but even though I sold practically over 100 copies of the hardcover edition, two of them fell apart.
Yikes.
One was mine. Oh. But it got a lot of use out of it. So I warn people, you know, just be gentle with it.
Yeah, I mean, it's tough to have a book that big. Like, that's a lot of folios.
They say they'll do over 1,000 pages.
All right, gotta get that Song of Ice and Fire fandom in there. Yeah, so going back to, you know, the original edition of Phoenix, you mentioned that at the time there was no, you know, there was not a lot of information out there on the internet. Mm-hmm. There was no Wikipedia. There weren't the sort of communities you have now. So what was the process of pulling together research for Phoenix?
Process was, well, there were some books out since the 80s, which had a little history section in them, which wasn't always right. There was one history book, and I can't think of the name of it. Well, I always said it was one history book for kids, and mine was but I went back to that book, and there was only really one chapter on it. And again, it's not correct. Plus all the magazines I had, you know, over the years, they would have some little bit of history. And so I had to gather one place to another. I had my press kits to go by too, but basically that was it. I didn't know anyone in the industry at that time or even how to contact anybody. There was no internet, nobody to look up. So, as I said, I started the book in 87 and finally finished it around 92.
So you didn't do a lot of interviews or
No, there's no interviews at all. Cold calls or anything like that.
It's all.
I mean, Steve Kent did all the interviews. Our books worked together.
Mm-hmm.
So, but no, I didn't interview anybody.
Okay. Yeah, the only game history book I can think of or something similar to it that predates Phoenix would be Game Over by David Sheff.
But that's
which is very specific to very Nintendo, to Nintendo.
Right. Mine's so it's the first general.
Right. Yeah, book. It's a good source of information, but it
and
is
his only came out like I mean mine was already finished when his came out.
Right.
He beat me to
yeah,
it.
he was kind of trying to jump on the sort of Nintendo panic around the NES. Parents are like, "Whoa, I don't know, there's this Japanese system in my living room. Are they taking over my kids' brains? What's going on?" So it was kind of riding on the coattails of that, but yeah, like I'm just saying like there weren't a lot of resources out there. So I'm actually the fact that you sort of pulled this together from all those resources to me, that's actually really impressive. Like it's difficult to just build something entirely by research that way. You said, you know, you had press kits and books and things like that. Were you able to source new material as you were researching, or was it built up mainly off just the things that you had acquired through the years?
It was through the things I acquired through the years. I mean, the early editions, and there's mistakes in it, like with the Channel F. I couldn't find anything on the Channel F, and I wanted to know why they changed the name from the Video Entertainment System to the Channel F. And so I put in there that they changed it because Atari came out with the VCS and they didn't want people to confuse the issue. But I didn't know if that was correct. I just put it out there. And then when I was researching the fourth edition, I said, I got to fix this.
Mm-hmm.
But every source I came to said the same thing I said. So I didn't know if that was true or they're getting it from me.
Right, the telephone effect.
We finally went to Jerry Lawson and he really didn't answer the question. He said it was a marketing decision. So that's what I went with. I mean, that's the best I can get. There was one system that ViewMaster put out. It's like a tape system.
I don't think I even knew about that one.
It's in the book.
Okay.
But I read somewhere that it won an award from the Toy Manufacturers of America, and I wanted to know what award it won. Couldn't find it anywhere. Went on the internet, everywhere I couldn't find it. I called the Toy Manufacturers of America, and I think the system came out in sometime in the 90s, and their records didn't go back that far. So I just had to go in the book. It won this award. I don't know what the award was. I just said it won an award.
So the in putting together, you know, these revised editions, are you finding a lot of things like that now that there is more research available?
Oh yeah, it's like a treasure trove. Things I were not aware of. Plus the new book contains a lot of Japanese history and European history.
Mm-hmm.
And just, you know, I go after one thing, find out one thing, and then I uncover more stuff. It's like an archaeologist.
So, and you still aren't getting a lot of like first party resource information for the books, like interviews and that sort of thing.
No, I still don't do interviews.
Right. Okay. That's an interesting approach. Like, I find interviews really valuable.
The problem with interviews is you're hearing one person's perspective, mm-hmm. and you don't know if they're right or wrong. And there's a certain co-founder of Atari who told his stories for 20 years.
That's true.
And when his partner finally told his story, he contradicted everything. So you're hearing in an interview that's his side, and memories are faulty, and so you don't know if it's right.
That's true. Yeah. I think, you know, for individual projects, interviews can be really valuable, but I guess it is kind of, you know, when you're dealing with something on the corporate level, like getting opinions,
history,
it's kind of like, yeah. you know, describing an elephant by having a lot of blind people touch it and kind of figure out like, what are we touching? So yeah, I can definitely see, where that would be the case. So in bringing in the Japanese and European history into your book, like how has that process gone? Has that been more challenging than putting together the original edition, or?
No, actually it wasn't, because there's more information available now. And the hardest thing was getting all the systems, because I like to take my own pictures and stuff. So, the information is out there. Like I said, I think I have the Japanese history pretty much covered. There's still a lot of the European that's not out there yet. Mm-hmm. And if I ever do another edition, hopefully I could get, you know, find that stuff. It's just so daunting. The book is so big now. I mean, where do I go from here?
Right. So. Yeah, I mean, you know, as years goes by, there's only going to be more and more history to cover. But do you feel like the material in the first edition, like, is that a pretty rock solid foundation at this point? There's not a lot of the basic information, like the rise of Atari and that sort of thing. Like,
the basic information is pretty correct. Mm-hmm. And every time, you know, if I find out there's something changed, I will change it. I'm not going to change something because someone told me, oh, this is wrong. I'll do the research first and change it. There is even with the fourth edition, there is a errata page on my website for all, you know, mistakes that have been uncovered. There's mistakes in the black and white edition that were fixed in the color edition, but then the color one, there's still, I mean, I had a fact checkers go over the book. Mm-hmm. I had an editor go over the book, but things still get through. Mm-hmm. I was really upset when the first review on Amazon came out for the fourth edition, and the person gave me a 2-star review. And he said, well, this is wrong, this is wrong, and this is wrong. And it turned out the early stuff, I mean, it took me 10 years to write this new book. Mm-hmm. And in those 10 years, because I did the early stuff first and went to the, a lot of stuff has been uncovered since then, and
right.
I didn't know that.
Right.
So he was listing all this stuff, and some stuff I agreed with, some I didn't. And, I wrote to him. I did a follow-up to his review and saying, well, this you're right, this you're not right. I don't agree with this. Turned out we became good friends now. And if I have a question now, because I call him, this guy, a video game archaeologist, because he works in a library. He has access to information I don't have, mm-hmm. like old Playmeter magazines and stuff, you know, the arcade side. So I'll go to him for information. One thing I mention is that the original Odyssey came out in Japan. And he says, no, it didn't. And I said, well, I think it did. And he did some research. He goes, yeah, I think you're right. And no one ever found a Japanese Odyssey. But what we think happened was that Magnavox exported them to Japan and just sold them, you know, over there. No, Nintendo imported the Odyssey over. That's
what the
story was. Yeah.
Interesting.
So he found something to prove it. We're still not 100% sure. But it makes kind of sense because Nintendo had a piece in the original Odyssey. I don't know if you're aware of this.
I did not know that.
Okay, the light gun that came, you know, you bought for the Odyssey. Nintendo made light guns that they sold since 1970.
Right, yeah, with like the Duck Hunt and everything. Yeah.
Right. So Magnavox hired Nintendo to manufacture the light guns for the Odyssey, and that's how they got into video games.
Okay. Interesting. So that actually kind of speaks to the things that make me interested in covering video game history is, you know, uncovering these connections and saying, oh, like, now I see why these things happen. It's because of this this chain of events. And finding those links and connections is always, it's very satisfying.
Well, the cool thing is, because I have the original Nintendo light gun, and it worked, it's a different technology than what Magnavox uses, because Magnavox, the gun recognizes the light on the screen, where the Nintendo one, the target, recognizes the light coming from the gun. If you could follow that.
Like the original Nintendo, like not the zapper for the NES.
No, the original hardware.
Yeah. You're shooting a beam.
Yeah. And the target will recognize the beam coming.
Yeah.
Where the Magnavox, it recognizes the light on the screen, which is like the opposite. But if you take the two rifles, the one from Magnavox and the one from Nintendo, you put them side, they're identical.
Same casing and
exactly
everything.
Exactly the same, except Magnavox has the cord to hook it up to the machine.
Huh. Okay, so yeah, that's like a missing link in video game history right there. Interesting. Have you been in contact with any of the companies that you cover? Because a lot of them do keep, you know, archival records. Like, I don't know if they do anymore because they've moved offices a few times, but Sega of America basically had a room where they just kept
everything. No, I haven't. I mean, I've been basing myself on books. There was one Sega book I used, and apparently it wasn't a good resource. I was told that the information in there was wrong, so...
Yeah, it's difficult to know what's right and what's wrong because, you know, you build on, like, this is something I've discovered in my own work, is that if you're building on things other people have talked about and written, there's that kind of, like, telephone game effect again.
Yeah, you're changed.
Yeah, like, you have the original information and then there's you, and then in between, things kind of shift around, so you have to do a lot of double-checking, and even then it's easy to get things wrong, or, you know, new information comes out where people are like, oh, well, we thought one thing, and that's what we'd been told, but now there's something different. Like, you know, Final Fantasy, the video game series Final Fantasy, there was an interview almost 20 years ago in Next Generation magazine that I remember summarizing and submitting to a game site that was running at the time, where the creator talked about the fact that like a direct quote from him saying it was called Final Fantasy because the company hadn't been doing that well. And he was like, you know, I've had it. This is it. If this doesn't work out, then I'm going. So it was his Final Fantasy. So that's where the name came from. And so that became, you know, that passed into sort of the internet wisdom about the game. And then like a year ago, the same guy gave an interview to a different publication and he said, oh no, that's not really true. We weren't going to go out of business or anything. I just called it Final Fantasy because I like, you know, the alliteration. I wanted something called FF.
Well, that goes.
So it's like the same guy, you know.
Well, that's why we go back to earlier when we were talking about interviewing people because not only the memory's faulty, so. You hear one thing, if they change it, which one's true then?
Right. So yeah, I mean, the question in covering video game history becomes, like, what's actually true? Like, what is bedrock? And everything else seems like shifting sands. It's really hard to know where to get your footing.
I mean, I'm happy that my book has a good reputation, that people go to it. And I would say 95% of it is true. It does bother me that it's not 100% true. If I can do that, I would do it. Every time I find, like I said before, if I find there's a mistake, I'm going to fix it. With the second edition, I put out new prints with the changes, but that's not feasible these days.
Yeah. I mean, I come across that all the time in my own work where, you know, I'm doing a pretty regular publication. I'm not on the same like book publishing schedule that you are. So, but I still try to do, you know, the research that I need to, and I'll check with resources when I have a question or even a vague doubt about something. And there'll be times when, you know, I think I've looked something up and found the correct facts about it, and I put together something and publish it, and then people are like, well, no, this thing is wrong. And I went and I looked it up and I fact-checked it, but I still got it wrong. And, you know, it's frustrating because you do the best you can, but there's only so much you can do.
Well, also, sometimes with me, there was one mistake I put in the fourth edition. I don't remember the details, but I gave the wrong year of when something came out. And I was wrong. And what gets me is I wrote an article in a book where I had the information correct in it. And I just, you know, glossed over it. Mm-hmm. And as a writer, you would know that you read your own stuff. even if it's wrong, you're reading it correct in your head. So it's tough.
Copy editing yourself is one of the hardest things in the world, because you're like, oh, yes, like everything lines up in your brain the way it is on the page, so you don't really question it.
And there's plenty of sentences that could be read two different ways, and you're reading it the way you want it read, but everyone else is going to read it the other way. Right. So.
Oh, language. So ambiguous. Yeah, but despite the challenges that this entails, like, I really do feel Phoenix is a really important work for, like, you know, it itself is kind of a bedrock for video game history. So I'm glad that you're still exploring, you know, like still working on the book and revising it, because like I said, you know, every year there's more history, but also being able to just bring in more resources, more facts and information. That's great. So like, is there a point at which you think you're going to say, well, this is it. This is as in-depth and as, you know, factual and corrected and everything as I'm going to get.
Well, it depends how the industry changes for the future anyway. I mean, we're getting away, they say we're getting away from consoles, but who knows?
Yeah, I don't know. I thought when this current generation started up, you know, that it was the end and, you know, they weren't going to do that well, and everyone is going to move over to cloud-based services.
And but now the Switch is like selling like hotcakes.
Yeah, well, so. And PS4 is one of the most successful consoles ever. So clearly I was mistaken, and the, you know, what I was reading as disinterest in the console industry was really just like that last generational cycle lasted too long, and so interest was flagging. But once new stuff came along, people were excited again. So, you know, the talk that we're hearing again about moving to cloud-based services and games as a service and subscriptions, that could also be like, well, this generation is reaching its end and people are interested
in
something new.
But again, Switch is bringing back physical horror.
Right.
So.
Yeah, I mean, it's crazy. Like, for a long time, everything except blockbuster games had moved to pretty much digital. And then Switch came along and it has cartridges that cost more than other formats, than disc formats. And yet, there's so many of these kind of like, you know, B-tier, not in terms of quality, but in terms of budget, like these sort of mid-tier games that have basically vanished from retail, all of a sudden coming back. So it's hard to predict how things are going to work.
I mean, I'll investigate it maybe 5 years, give this book a 5-year life, and then see, you know, and I'm getting old. So.
Yeah, but the great thing about something like video games and even writing is that I feel like they're the kind of things you just keep doing. Like they're.
Well, I have two more video game books planned.
Okay.
Which I'm co-writing with Rob Feraldi, who you met in Portland. I can't say what they are yet. We're trying to work a publishing deal because I don't want to do it myself this time, the publishing. So I think they're going to be pretty good. But
do you think you'll revisit ABC to the VCS at some point?
No,
or do you think
that's pretty much
definitive.
I'm asked about that. I would love to. But the problem is with that is there's just so many homebrews out there that I can't keep up with them.
Yeah, it's a really slippery kind of slope.
And I'm a perfectionist. I want all or that's it. And so again, I would love to, but I don't see it happening.
Yeah, I've kind of run across that with my attempts to chronicle like the NES and Super NES libraries. I want to do some post-release content, you know, post-licensing content. But where do you draw the line? Do you say, well, only things that have received, you know, an actual physical release,
right?
But then there's some things that were, you know, given a run of 50 copies. So those are selling for hundreds of dollars now. Do I need to include those? It's really hard to kind of draw the definition. And even within the licensed space, you know, there's multiple versions of a game, like, you know, stadium events, world-class track meet. That's a really famous example of one version that's worth like $20 and one version that's worth 1,000 times that. And, so it's something that people like us who are actually trying to write about history have to worry about. And I think people who are just, you know, reading about it or listening to podcasts about it or whatever, like they don't have to worry about that crap. It's just kind of like, how do we organize things? But I feel like it does make a difference because the choices historians and archivists make in terms of organization and what to cover and who to talk to and what resources to look for, like that shapes the histories that we create. And, you know, we are ultimately editorializing and adding our own flavor and our own perspectives to the history we create. We are not objective in any sense. So, I mean, you know, you didn't like Nintendo for a long time.
But I didn't put that in my book.
No. But, you know, like, and I you know, for a long time didn't really care for Sega games. And so these things inevitably come out and people complain about this podcast because we don't cover Sega enough. So
they'll complain about everything.
Sure. But
I mean, one of the reasons I don't review games is because I'm thinking, who am I to review games? What do I know? And like, I'm not a fan of fighting games at all. And you could have the best fighting game in the world. I'm not going to like it. So how could I review a game like that? So that's what, so I just like being objective, telling the facts straight is, and that's it.
So just to kind of wrap up here, I guess, what would your advice be as someone who has been writing about video game history for 35 years now, basically? I mean, if you want to go back to ABC to the DCS.
Yeah, since 82, so.
Yeah. So what would your advice be to people who are interested in exploring game history on their own and trying to figure out what really happened out there?
Read my book.
But people who want to, you know, to kind of do their own research and their own explorations.
No, do all the research you can and just make sure it's correct. Because the problem is that there is a lot of bad information going out there too, especially on YouTube. And people, especially YouTube, take it, well, that's what they said. That has to be the way it is. And there's not enough research going out on some of the YouTube channels. So if you're going to do one yourself, just make sure it's correct. A lot of people are vicious out there. They will get you if they know it's wrong, including me. So.
All right. Well, that's actually good advice. That's, yeah. All right. So just to wrap, where can people find you on the internet and where can they find your projects and purchase your books and so on and so forth?
I have a website, relentapress.com, which is built in 2000 and it looks that way. But I'm on Facebook. There's my page, Leonard Herman. There's the Game Scholar page. Phoenix 4 has a page of its own. Basically, my page will tell about my upcoming projects as I get them. Problem is, it's also a personal page, so a lot of personal stuff gets on there. But that's where I am. I'm on Twitter, but I really don't use it that much. And I come to shows when I can.
All right. And your books are Phoenix 4 and ABC to the VCS.
Well, ABC to the VCS is out of print.
Oh, is it?
It's been out of print for years.
Okay. Well, you guys can't have my copy.
The only other book I have in print right now is Ralph Baer's book, which I published and edited, Video Games in the Beginning. Mm-hmm. Both of them are available on Amazon also. That's a pretty good book, too. I mean, I'm really proud of that one, Ralph's book. And like I said, I'm working on two other books. I'm working on a novel now, which is unfortunately taking all my time.
All right. Well, thank you for taking your time to share your perspectives and history here. And good luck with the next book projects you're developing, whatever those may happen to be.
Oh, thank you so much for having me on. It was great to meet you and to talk with you.
All right. Well, and the usual spiel applies for Retronauts, retronauts.com, iTunes. Support us through Patreon at patreon.com/retronauts. And I can be found on Twitter and other social media. Jeremy Parrish, GameSpite on Twitter, on Facebook, etc. Thanks for listening, everyone. We'll be back in a few days with a full-length episode. Look forward to it.